Why not?
You'll be able to let anybody else in, will you?
Yes, of course.
I can get rid of that. Okay, good. Well, welcome again, or welcome if you're new. And I'm going to start by recapping for 10 minutes or so something I said slightly greater length last time, partly because it's relevant and interesting, but also to then feed into what we're going to do next. So what we did was we had a look, or I started to read from Genesis chapter 12, and we were looking for something that was weird. We've been thinking about what happens when we come across something in the scripture that strikes us as really odd, very unexpected, totally strange, and weird in the sense of it doesn't belong to our world at all. It sticks out as something which would have been fine for them, and probably fine therefore for Jewish people reading it, but doesn't make so much sense for us. And either we read straight past it for that reason, because that's the way our brains work, or we just scratch our heads and stay puzzled. So I'm picking up from before what I said about Abraham and his family. So in Genesis 12, the Lord said to Abraham, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household." And at that point, it gets weird. Because to leave your father's household, the bet av, literally the house of your father, was something that was totally unheard of. This was not something that naturally happened. Today, of course, people grow up, they leave home, they get married, they start their own families and so on. But in those days, in a patriarchal system, you stayed to support your father. As sons, you were the legacy of your father. You did the same job. Basically, you took over either looking after his sheep and goats or the same sort of profession. You continued to receive your support and provision from the father. And if you got married, then the woman, become your wife, she had to leave her father's household and become part of your father's household to build up the lineage and the legacy from there. But the other crucial thing about being part of your father's household was that it meant that everybody in the same household worshipped the same gods. So we got here that Abraham, or Abram as he was then, would be worshipping, before he left, the same gods of Mesopotamia that he knew within his father's household, Terah, his father. Just before I say more about that, it's worth bearing in mind what I've just said also feeds into other things. If you think of the story that Jesus told of the prodigal son, the big shock at the beginning of the story is that one of the sons goes to his father and says, "I'm going to leave. Give me my money, I'm off now," which is a way of saying, "I wish you were dead because I want to get on with my life without you." Because until the father of the household died, you were part of that household. And of course, the other big shock of that story is that the father said, "Yes, okay, then, here it is, off you go." So that would be something that, again, was much a sort of stronger statement early in that story than we realise. And equally, Jesus, although at the age of 12 he was in the temple and he was about his father's business and so on, when eventually his parents found him, he went back with them. It says he submitted to them, he was obedient to them, and of course he stayed with them until he was 30, and he learned his father's trade. And it wasn't until his father had died that he began his ministry. And another sort of relevant point in all this, you'll be aware that once you get into, say, the book of Acts, you find that whole households convert, because that's the same idea, that the whole household would follow the same God. So if the head of the household became a follower of Jesus, then everybody else would. And that seems strange to us because we think about individual conversion, things like that. But in those days, that's the way it happened, as households. Anyway, we've got Abraham being told by God to leave his father's household, and that would mean leaving behind everything that he knew about his father's gods. And his father's gods, the Mesopotamian gods, would have featured very strongly in all the stories that he knew at that point. Because like every culture, they had their stories about creation, about the flood, about Babel, all the sort of things that we read in the first 11 chapters. Abraham would have had versions of those stories, but with the wrong God, and therefore with the wrong meaning, the wrong interpretation, the wrong outcome, if you like. And Abraham was going to have to relearn all these stories, but with the God who really was at the center of it, as he started to follow Yahweh. Now, really, the point is that Abraham's household doesn't really begin in chapter 12. There are no chapter numbers. We should really have started back in chapter 11 and verse 27, where it talks about the account of Terah, the account or the generations of Terah. And those are the true division signs for the book of Genesis. There are 10 of them, where suddenly it says, this is the account of, or this is the, these are the generations of. And the account or generations of Terah means that this is the story of his children, of his lineage, of his household, if you like. So we grappled with some of the details and intricacies of the last few verses of chapter 11 to try and understand this household that Abraham was so wrapped up in. And we learned that his father Terah started to have children when he was 70 years old. You could say that's a bit weird in our terms, but that wasn't that weird for them. And we learn about three brothers, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And it's very easy to believe or think that that means that was the order in which they were born. And therefore, Abram would be the eldest or the firstborn. But the numbers actually don't stack up on that. And in fact, as you will see, perhaps when we look at earlier stories in Genesis, the list of children isn't based upon birth order necessarily, it's based upon significance or importance. So the reason they're in this order is because Abraham was going to become the most significant person of the household of Terah. The stories to follow are going to involve him. Second most important would be Nahor. He does come back into the stories later. And Haran, of course, doesn't because he dies. So Haran marries, and he marries first. And if you wonder, that seems a bit strange because surely the firstborn tends to marry first, but it's quite possible that Haran is the firstborn. So he marries and he has some children who grow up, Lot, we know about, and two daughters, Milcah and Ishkar. And then Haran dies while they're still in Ur of the Chaldees before any of the journeying happens. And at this point, it says that both Abraham and Nahor get married. And the structure of the sentence, something to do with the Hebrew, the grammar of it, which I am not always fully conversant with, but occasionally we will look at the Hebrew and this sort of thing. It suggests that they both decided to get married at that point, as though the death of their brother spurred them on to think, well, we'd better get married soon. And have children in case we die. So it's almost like a collective decision. Now is our time to get married. Let's do this. And if you notice, again, this might seem a bit weird, that Nahor marries his niece, Milcah, in other words, his dead brother's daughter, which is another indication that she's already grown up enough and that therefore Haran was probably the firstborn. And the other two came along later, but probably much later when you look at the figures, which I'm not going to try and go into. But Nahor marries Milcah, one of Haran's daughters. And then it suddenly says Abraham marries Sarai. And there's no indication at all where she comes from. There's no recognition of her household, of her father. So suddenly she's mentioned. And women are only mentioned in stories like this if they are to become significant, which of course Sarah very much was. You'll notice that Haran's wife isn't mentioned at all. For instance, I don't even think Terah's wife is actually mentioned. So Abraham marries Sarai, but there's a mention that Haran had two daughters, Milcah and Ishkar. And what Jewish tradition says, and having looked into this, I feel this is quite reasonable, though I can't prove it to you, that actually Ishkar and Sarai are the same person, different names for the same person. They tend to mean the same thing, roughly, to do with princess. And it would look as though Ishkar is the sort of Mesopotamian name, her birth name. But when her father died, and if she married, therefore, Uncle Abraham, she took on another name or another version of her name, which, of course, God would also change later to Sarah. So what's going on in these verses is that the two brothers that survived both married at roughly the same time their nieces who were left without a father once Hosea died. Now, if you're thinking at this point, yeah, of that, this does seem strange. Yes, it does. And some of you might be thinking, well, I remember when later on in the stories when Abraham lied about Sarah and said, she is my sister, to try and get himself out of trouble. And one of the stories, if you want to check it out, it's in chapter 20 and verse 12, when he's been caught out on this with Abimelech. He adds, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. At this point, it seems that Abraham is saying, she's sort of like a sister, but a half-sister. And what do we make of that? Well, that shows why there's no mention of Sarai's family line, as though she came from a different household altogether. But does it actually mean that she could have been Abraham's niece? Is that what really is my sort of sister means? She's the daughter of my father. Now, once her real father had died, if Haran was her real father, then her grandfather becomes her father within the household. So for Abraham to say she is the daughter of my father, i.e. of Terah, would be accurate, given that her actual physical father was no longer around. And in fact, there's no Hebrew word for grandfather, grandson, granddaughter. So you can't really tell if you just say someone is my father, whether you mean literal father or an ancestor early on. And the other thing we sort of know about Abram and Sarah is that their ages were pretty close together. They're 10 years apart. If you think about when Abram was 100, Sarah was 90. So that would also fit the fact that Abram was a younger brother of these three, and he married, therefore, a grown-up daughter of his elder brother. So all these little things fit in within this very strange household that we read about in these verses. I say, I can't prove it anymore, but if that's what Jewish tradition says, the point about it is that because women are not mentioned unless they become significant, there is absolutely no reason why Ishkar would have been mentioned in these verses. She doesn't marry someone else. She disappears from the story. And that would be really, really weird for the Jewish people reading this or hearing this story, unless they already knew something about her. The other weird thing is that at this point we learn that Sarai was barren. And that means that Abraham, whether he had the choice of the nieces or whether Nahor had the choice, Abraham ended up with the one who couldn't provide him with children, and therefore his lineage was going to die out. His name, his side of the household, if you like, would actually die out. He couldn't make a name for himself through his children. So although we learn that Sarah was very beautiful, she wasn't able to give him children. Now, we know how God is going to work this story out, but at this point, you've got Abraham being called to leave his father's household, and who does he take with him? Well, obviously his wife, who can't give him children. And he also takes with him his nephew, Lot. Lot went with him. Abraham probably thinking, well, at least Lot will be able to have children. And if Lot can have children, then they become part of my bet are. If I've got to start a new household out of all this, and I can't have children of my own at this point, well, at least I can build my house, my household up through Lot. Although we know that that relationship didn't actually work out all that spectacularly at times either. So that's some of the weirdness that we find towards the end of chapter 11. And I left you, and some of you hope will already have been thinking about this, there's an awful lot of weirdness in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And we're going to explore that together in the coming weeks. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you what you actually found, what weirdnesses you think are there, and we'll make a list of them. And then I'll decide which one we'll look at today and which one another time, and so on. But I want to stress that by looking at these chapters, I'm trying to look at them slightly differently from normal, perhaps. I'm looking at them through the eyes, or the ears, rather, of Abraham, who would hear these stories, having come out of Mesopotamia, where he had to leave behind all the equivalent stories that had a wrong God attached to them. How would he have learnt about the God he was now following from these stories? God is the central character of these stories. How do they teach Abraham about who God really is? So that's one way to get into these stories a bit differently from that point of view. Now, I want to stress that, of course, we do have later revelation. We have not just the rest of the Old Testament, but we have the New Testament. And at times the writers in the New Testament tell us things going back into those 11 chapters of Genesis, which Abraham didn't know about, didn't have that extra revelation. And I'm not suggesting that we will ignore that. We can't and we shouldn't. But at the same time, it's worthwhile trying to read it as though we were a first-time reader or a first-time hearer of these stories that Abraham would hear as he started his new life of journeying and wandering around and meeting other people who would be passing these stories on. The other thing is that within these 11 chapters, there are so many things that are happening for the very first time. And because things become common to us, we don't pick up just how strange it must have been for something to happen for the very first time. I don't want to tell you what they are in advance, but I'll just say one, and that's rain. Now, it's been raining here today. It didn't bother me one little bit. I've seen rain before. But if it's the first time you've seen water fall out of the sky, then that could be quite frightening. That could be quite a different experience from what we might understand when we just read, oh, it rained. Okay. And there'll be lots of things in these chapters which are firsts and therefore should jolt us into thinking, what did they really make of something that happened for the first time? Something that we've got used to. So that's the background to what we're going to do. And from time to time, I will, if necessary and helpful, call up the Hebrew of some of these passages, because sometimes the weirdness is in the English translation rather than the Hebrew. In fact, sometimes it's in the Hebrew. But at that point, I want to stop. And I think if there's just 25 people, are there some more here now? How many have we got in total? 26. All right. I think what we'll do is we won't do what I thought I might do, but we'll stay together. Okay, so we'll keep the recording going. Now, what I want for the next few minutes is for you to tell me what you feel is really weird in anything in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And I'm going to make a list of them. And then we'll start to see how we go from there. If you've come prepared, has anyone come prepared with a list? Because you've already done your homework, so to speak. Has anyone actually got a list? Okay, because what I don't want is someone to reel off sort of 10 things and nobody else gets a chance. I'd rather you said them one at a time. We're going to unmute you to say them, okay? So you either raise your hand, although someone's put something in the chat. If you are chatting, please don't chat to everyone. It gets distractive. So either raise your hand, or you can chat to me directly through the chat. But I'll make a note of the first one that's come through, and I'm not surprised someone has mentioned the Nephilim. Okay, we will look at that at some point. Mary, you've got your hand up.
In Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the next verse tells us that everything was dark and void. And I'm thinking, surely if God created the heavens and the earth, he wouldn't be creating something that was dark and had no form.
Okay, so you're puzzled by the very opening of the creation story.
And that had occurred to me that between verses 1 and 2 maybe was when Satan fell.
Okay,
But
well,
that's
we will,
just
yeah, okay.
thought.
We don't need to try and work out what the weirdness is about at this point. We just need to list them, really. Anybody else got anything? In anywhere in the first 11 chapters, there must be
Okay.
something.
Maureen. Can you unmute, Maureen?
Hello, hello. I actually didn't get past the first chapter. So that was a first.
Okay, but do you have anything to add to the list, please? We don't want to take too long on this bit.
sorry,
Do you have
sorry.
something to add to the list?
Yes, I was surprised when I read down through that the first day, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And it goes on to say, "The evening and the morning were the first day."
So you're puzzled by.
And when I read down through to chapter, what verse is it? I think it's 14. 14. Yeah. And I read down to 14, verse 14. And then I read, and God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament." That's a good word, firmament.
Okay, so what actually is the point you want me to write down? What is the weird thing that we need to look at?
The fact is that it says the heaven divided the day from the night, and that was on the fourth day.
Okay, all right, I've got your point, thank you. You can raise your hand either by the little symbol, or you can wave your hand around and see if we can pick you up. I think Elaine, I saw you trying to wave your hand
Yes.
around, so thank you.
Unmute. You need to unmute yourself, Elaine. Then Betty.
Yeah. So I was where it says in verse 3 of chapter 1, "Let there be light," and there was light, and then God's then verse 4, "And dividing light from the darkness." So there, it means there has to be, it's the first time that there's a concept of time. And how did they necessarily know that God, that's what God called it?
Okay.
If these were things for the first time, like light and day.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I've made a note of it. We'll see where we go when we
Right.
have some more. I'm
Okay.
hoping some have
Thank
got
you.
something that's not in the first chapter.
Okay.
Let's.
Betty was next.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I can
Yeah,
see the other hands.
I was wondering about the serpent, Paul, and
Okay.
if the serpent was the devil, and if man had authority over all the beasts, I'm just wondering how that happened.
Okay, very good point. That is very, very weird once you get to that bit. The weirdness
Okay.
really kicks in at this point. Good.
Yes. Next one, Val. Can you unmute yourself?
Chapter 4, verse 15. God puts a mark on Cain.
Yeah.
That's a bit weird. We don't know what mark it was.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Anybody else?
Miriam?
And Enoch walked with God and he was not.
Yeah, okay.
Then Jeremy?
chapter 4, verse 22, I think, we're given the name Nehemiah, which seems odd because it's so economic normally.
Economic, you mean?
Well, we don't normally hear the name of the girls, do we?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've got something to say on that eventually. It may not be today, because I've circled it. It might have to do with what the name means. But certainly, that's an interesting point. Thank you. Anybody else?
Elaine again, can you unmute?
Unmuting. So how do we know where the the first, where Eve and Adam actually stemmed from, apart from what it says in the scripture? But is there any more light or background on where that actually stemmed from?
No, we're only looking at what's in the scripture.
Okay.
Yeah, we're just looking at the text.
Right, sorry.
Could have been heard.
Yeah.
And understanding from that point of view. So what you might think is weird is the way that Eve was created, for instance.
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'll grant you that one.
Val?
Chapter 11, for us it's really weird that the whole earth had one language and one speech.
Yeah.
And then also I don't think there's a mention of a city and a tower having been built before.
Ah, so one of the first, say?
Yes.
Well, we'll have to see whether that is a real first. Certainly, there is something first about this. Okay. Anybody else?
Angela, can you unmute yourself?
Who are the sons of God so that the daughters of humans are the sons of God?
Right. Okay, so that's the passage that someone mentioned earlier where the Nephilim come in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah, that's fine. You picked a slightly different aspect of it, which is fairly good. So that's, again, is sort of chapter 6. Yeah.
Lynn, you need to unmute.
Okay. Chapter 9, verse 24. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew that his youngest son, what his youngest son had done to him.
Yeah.
How would he know that if he was asleep?
Well, that's very interesting. And the whole of that bit is really, really weird. Mm-hmm. So you picked out verse, whatever it was, 24.
Yeah,
but to me, the whole of that is one of the weirdest bits. So I might mention that fairly soon. It's fairly self-contained, that. okay, but I'll keep taking further suggestions. Of course, you can come up with some more for next week, and next week it's not all over today and so on.
Okay, Miriam?
I'm always fascinated that God shut the door of the ark.
Okay, that he actually did it.
Yeah.
Is there a verse about that?
Yeah, I can't find it at the moment, but there is.
Okay. If you can find it, let us know. But I mean,
yes, I will.
We know roughly where it's going to be, so don't worry. I mean, if you think that's the only strange bit of the flood story, well, no, there's a lot more that's strange about it. but we'll bear that in mind. I'll take one or two more, perhaps, but then I'll...
Jeremy.
I'll start with something.
To be honest, I'm not sure I've sorted out the order in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
The order in the sense of?
We have... in Genesis 2, it sounds as if Adam is around before things have actually been formed properly.
Okay. So what's weird is the difference between the two chapters and how they might fit together.
Yes, I'm working on it. I'm not sure I've got that.
Okay, well, I'll say something about that, certainly, maybe later today, because there seems to be a lot of interest in the early chapters. Anybody else at this point?
Yes, Lynn again.
Just that one about God closing the door was chapter 7, verse 16.
Thank you.
And Mary has a hand up.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about all the animals making their way to the ark. I don't think Noah went out and got them. I think they came up the revelation.
Yeah. Yes. They somehow, that is interesting, somehow they sensed what God wanted them to do.
Yeah.
Maybe through the change of climate that was coming up, all sorts of things like that. Okay, well, you can tell me some more as you think of them or save them up for next week. We've certainly got plenty to get going. And really, it's just a way of me deciding which bit to do first. So because you mentioned it, I am going to tackle, first of all, which means if you want to read it, chapter 9, verses 18 to the end. So chapter 9, verses 18 to the end. So just in case we need it, this is the, I think the Hebrew bit. But you have a read of it first of all. You might find there's even more weirdness in those verses than you thought. Has anybody come up with anything else in that story that they think is really weird?
Val has a hand up, and then Lynn.
Verse 19, the three that were mentioned in verse 18, Shem, Ham and Japheth, were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was populated. There's no mention of any women in amongst that lot.
Well, okay. They're not mentioned, but they did have wives, as you know, in the ark with them. So they did come out with them at the same time.
All right, okay.
That's another comment.
Yeah. It's just interesting in Genesis 9 again. I'm just looking at 20, where it said Noah began to be a farmer and he planted a vineyard, then he drank of the wine and was drunk. I mean, did they know much about how wine was actually made in those days?
Well, because, that's a very good point.
On grape juice would take quite a lot.
Yes. This is another first. This is the first time we read about a vineyard and someone getting drunk. So that might sort of stand out for us. It would seem as though somehow, at this point, Noah has discovered what to do with grapes, and he's overdone it. Okay, this might be the first time he's got drunk or not, but he's probably going to regret his drunkenness.
Yes. Pat.
Oh, go on then, keep going.
Pat.
Okay, it's just in verse 9 and 10, it talks about a covenant with living.
We're not in that passage, Pat. We're starting at verse 18.
Oh, right. Sorry then.
Okay.
Okay. Mary? You need to unmute yourself, Mary.
Having a problem.
There you go.
I was just wondering how long it would take to grow vines to get wine. Yeah.
Well, you're right. Obviously, this is some time later. It says in verse 20, Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. You always get the impression these things happen sort of all in a rush. But between that and the next verse, when he drank some of its wine, then there's probably a long time passed in between.
Right.
That.
Okay.
There's an interesting link that's going to keep coming through all these stories about those who are a man of the soil. That little phrase isn't there just because it's not needed. The first man of the soil, of course, was?
Adam.
Adam. The next man of the soil was Cain. Okay. And we're going to find this link between the man and the ground, the earth, from which obviously the first man came, is always going to be a key sort of moment in things. It sort of links the stories together and it drives them on. So I'll start to tell you things now then. Verse 18, it talks about the sons of Noah, who have been mentioned before, I think in chapter 5, verse 32. After Noah was 500 years old, that's weird, but perhaps it isn't. In fact, Abraham, in all the stories he knew from Mesopotamia, usually people had even longer lives, okay? Probably even tens of thousands. So he was used to that. He wouldn't have thought, oh, I'm hearing now about a chap who was 500 and had some sons. That wouldn't have fazed him at all. So he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, remember what I said about the order of these? This is not their birth order. This is the order of their importance. Why is that the order of their importance, do you think? Why is it written in that order, given that they're not oldest to youngest?
Because from Shem came Abraham.
I guess. Shem is the main line, the most significant person of the three. He is the father of the Semites, which is what the rest of the story is all about. Okay. Why do you think Ham is second? There's a little hint that follows immediately.
Canaan, the land of Canaan.
Well, he's the father of Canaan. That's the next most important. Now, Japheth, what on earth do we know about Japheth? What, who were his sons? Where did he end up? Do we know? Not so much. We're much more familiar with, from our stories, the other ones.
Well, Japheth has got Magog in his line, hasn't he?
Yes, you can see that.
And Tarshish and...
Yes, but...
Ashkenaz, which is what, German? So all the nations, I suppose.
Well, he ended up, I think, in the northern part, Greece, heading towards Europe sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the point is that from our point of view of the story, Shem, Ham is the youngest. We know that from what we're about to read. Ham is the youngest. Japheth is probably the eldest, probably. It sort of follows a little bit from things that follow. But Ham is definitely the youngest, so we know this is not the birth order. But we keep getting twice, it says, Ham was the father of Canaan. Mm. It's as though the storyteller really wants us to know that. He's the father of Canaan. He's the father of Canaan. Can you see how that crops up in verse 22 as well? Mm-hmm. So that's our background to another very weird sort of family. And then comes this strange incident where he gets drunk. And then he says that Ham saw his father's nakedness, went and told his two brothers. They then did something. And then eventually Noah woke from his wine and starts cursing Canaan.
Mm.
Canaan. Why Canaan?
Yeah.
Now that is super weird. Okay. In fact, the whole thing is super weird. The first thing we've got to sort out is what this father's nakedness actually is. And there's three possible answers to that. Does anyone think they know or have heard of what actually his father's nakedness was actually all about?
I've heard that it was like a homosexual thing.
Yeah, that is like, definitely one thing. The word saw... I can make this bigger. I put it up here. I might as well try and use it. The word saw... lost it. Here we are. Which must be... I've got to try and get this sorted out now. Here we are. And saw... There must be that word here. Saw Ham, the father of Canaan, the nakedness of his father. That's the way the phrase works. Okay, Ervat is going to be a very key word And I'll say something about that, even if we don't go any further with it at this point. So that's the and saw Ham. The verb always comes first in Hebrew. And saw Ham, the father of Canaan, the nakedness of his father. Now the word saw always doesn't just mean he sort of glanced and saw it. Oh dear, I've seen that. It means he looked upon it in a certain way. Can you think of an earlier story in Genesis where somebody looked at something and the consequences were quite strong?
They saw the fruit. Eve saw the fruit.
Yeah. Well, eventually we'll look at that. And although someone's mentioned the serpent, there's a whole load of weirdness in that chapter. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree, that wasn't just, oh, that looks nice. There's something going on. There's a desire attached to that. It's a seeing that leads to an action that isn't necessarily a good thing. Okay. So we're getting a bit of a feel for this, that he saw something and took action. He did something. Now, one of the options, and it could well be the one that is the most likely, is that when he saw his father naked, he thought, I'll do something here, shall we say. He isn't going to notice. He's well asleep. In fact, he's in a drunken stupor. I can do something here. I wonder what it'd be like. What sort of fun I can have here. And then, of course, he goes outside and he told his two brothers, means he was boasting about it, really. He said, hey, guess what I've just done, sort of thing. We'll come back to the other two brothers in a moment. Any idea what the other options are that people have come up with for this strange act? Anyone heard of any? Or got anything in a footnote to your Bible or anything? No? Well, the strangest of them all, and I'm going to have to say this, but I'll tell you why I just don't think it's right. He saw his father's nakedness and castrated him. Now, why he would do that, I've got no idea, other than somehow he didn't want any more siblings. But the reason I dismiss it, although it's in the Jewish Midrash on these things, is that it wasn't till Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done. I don't think there's any way you stay asleep, however long you are, if suddenly you are being castrated. I just can't see that. So I think that's fanciful. It is interesting, it says Noah awoke from his wine, not from his sleep. That must be a phrase which is telling you what kind of sleep he was in and how it took him a while to come round from it. And then he found out what his youngest son had done. Now, the other option, which is a very interesting one and might be right, is based upon Leviticus chapter 20. So I'd like you to turn to Leviticus chapter 20. And this will all depend on what kind of version you've got. So I'm going to try and call it up and get away from Genesis for a moment. Come back to that. But Leviticus chapter 20. And I'm going to ask you if anyone has got a translation that might shed some light on this.
Which verse are you going for?
Well, I think it's pretty well... no, it isn't. It isn't the whole chapter. So I think let's go from about 11 onwards, is it? If you go from verse 11 onwards, basically, what is the chapter about from this point?
Immorality.
What particular kind?
Penalties for breaking the law.
Yeah, but which laws?
Incest.
Right, incest. Or basically, sexual relations with your family. If you pick it up from verse 11, has anyone got a translation for verse 11 which might shed some light on it? Let's try and
If there is a man who lies with his father's wife, he has uncovered his father's nakedness.
Right.
Both of them shall surely be put to death.
Right. If you have a look at what I've put up here, you've got every single, if you have a literal translation or go back into the authorized or something, the whole idea of sexual relations is called uncovering someone's nakedness. And you've got here again, Ervat Aviv, the nakedness of the father. Okay. So actually having sex with your mother is described as uncovering your father's nakedness, because the nakedness isn't the father's own nakedness. It's the nakedness that he alone is entitled to, namely his wife's. He is the only person that is allowed to, shall I put it like this, enjoy the nakedness of that particular woman. And the whole of this Leviticus passage keeps using this phrase, uncovering the nakedness of, to mean having sexual relations with. So the other option is that what's going on here in Genesis 9, if I can get it up again, towards the end, is that actually there is another person involved in this, namely Mrs. Noah. Because you could ask yourself, why is Noah naked in his tent in the first place? He became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Well, we can guess what might have been happening. in other words, he wasn't alone at this point. And therefore, probably Mr. and Mrs. Noah are both lying naked. And Ham goes in and thinks, ah, I can take advantage of this. So you've got the two choices. He either has sex with his mother, or he's interfered with his father in some way. Sorry about the gruesome details, but there it is. It's perhaps sort of expressed a little bit more sort of better in the actual text about father's nakedness and so on, but it's talking about something like that. So basically, whatever you want to think of those, but I do suggest you don't take the castration one much more seriously, is that he did something of that kind. And then he boasted about it. Now, the two brothers then do something about it. So they take the garment, they laid it across their shoulders, and they walked in backwards, and they covered up their father's nakedness, which could mean either their father or their mother. And they walked in backwards so as not to have the same temptation. Okay? In fact, three times you get the phrase, their father's nakedness, or his father's nakedness. One of the things to get used to in these stories, if something is repeated a lot, it is significant. This is the way the storytellers work. There's a phrase for it in Hebrew, I can't remember what it is now, but it's how you get the main points across. So he saw his father's nakedness, they took a garment and covered their father's nakedness so they would not see their father's nakedness.
Or can I ask something?
Yeah.
Would it necessarily have been his mother? Because weren't they polygamous in that time?
Yeah, but there probably wasn't any other woman around. We don't mean to know her marrying anybody else.
Ah, right.
They can be, and they will be later. But at this point, well, I know we don't know exactly how many years has passed, but I don't think there are any other women around that we mentioned. But interesting question, always worth asking that sort of thing.
I could ask one thing. Wouldn't his mother be sort of fighting with him?
Well, it depends whether she was a bit drunk as well, okay? Or it might be that, I mean, I don't want to pretend I know much about this sort of thing, obviously, but maybe by taking advantage of her, he was able to quieten her at the same time. Or maybe she made a noise, but it didn't actually awake Noah. Yeah. I agree. There are extra, well, every time you come across what you think is an answer, this probably raises more questions. So on. But the point is that when he eventually did wake up, he found out what his youngest son had done to him. Now, again, we're not told what that is, which is fascinating, really. We know something sexual has gone on, something bad has gone on. And all we know is that he flies into a complete rage with all these curses. And we'll look at that in a moment, because that's also a key part of it. Another reason why the castration thing is nonsense is because there's no way that the other two brothers could do the same thing again. So they would never be tempted to uncover their father's nakedness. You can only castrate someone once, is what I'm trying to say. So that doesn't work. But when he says that the two brothers took a garment and laid it across their shoulders, that might remind you of where we've had a few minutes ago, Abraham and Nahor both married. And I perhaps didn't stress that quite enough, but if they'd married separately, it would have said Abraham married and his wife's name was Sarai, Nahor married and his wife's name was Milcah. By saying that they both married, that's the clue that it was a joint decision. The brothers got together and decided to do something. And we got the same thing here, because Shem and Ham took a garment, okay, so between them they did something. When they heard what had happened, they got together and said, we need to do something. And it was a collective decision. It's two people doing one act, effectively, at the same time. So they don't both take a garment each. They took a garment, laid it across their shoulders, and then together they did this. That's an interesting link with the two brothers getting married later on, I think. So they did... Yeah?
Is there a significance that Shem's name is before Japheth then?
Only in that he's the most significant again. So once the order is established, that's the order that seems to crop up, unless there's a reason in the text for changing it round. The only thing, and I don't know enough about this from your point of view, but if two people collectively do the same action, do it together, then the first named person is the one who has made the decision what to do. So you could read into it, but this is probably reading too much into it. Shem said to his brother Japheth, let's do this now. Let's take a garment. And Japheth says, yes, okay. So the first mentioned actually comes up with the idea. But I think that might be trying to read a bit more into it. And then you get the really weird bit. Well, no, it's been weird enough already, hasn't it? Sorry. Why does he curse Canaan? Why not Ham? Anybody got any ideas why he blurts out, cursed be Canaan? I hope you might, because I've not got much idea on this one. But it certainly seems weird.
Would Canaan be born at this point?
Yes. Now, that is interesting, because we've had this hint repeatedly. Ham was the father of Canaan. Okay? But that doesn't necessarily mean that he already is. It could just be telling us something. And there is a weird suggestion that actually, if what Ham did was actually have sex with his mother, could it be that that is where Canaan came from? Now, I don't really buy into that. I think Canaan probably was already born, because otherwise I don't think Noah would have been able to say, curse be Canaan, because the child isn't around yet. But that's another speculation that's cropped up in it. But it's like, well, firstly, we looked at curses, didn't we? Some time back, did I do that study with you on curses? This is a very strong word that he's using, and it's really a word that that only God is allowed to use. We saw in some cases God cursed, and in other cases men cursed. It's almost as though Noah is, you could say he's overstretching things here. He's almost trying to, it's almost like a revenge thing, trying to be like God in this. But he brings the curse down upon Ham's line. And that would be a curse that would have to be lived out. And of course, he contrasts it with blessing upon Shem and Japheth, but particularly Shem, because Canaan is going to be the slave of Shem. Oh, and also Japheth will live in the tents of Shem and so on. So somehow, out of Noah's anguish or problems that he's had with what's happened to him, he comes up with these probably quite prophetic statements. But that's something that sort of works out later in the story. But he curses, of course, in poetry as well, interesting enough. You can see it's in a poetic form, and the blessing is in poetry. And at that point, that's the end of Noah, really. After that, he lived 350 years, 950 in total, and then he died. So after all that we've learned about Noah through the flood story, which is how people know about Noah, we've suddenly got tacked on to the end of it, this extraordinary little account. We don't know how many years have gone by since the flood. It could be a lot, because it says after the flood he lived 350 years. So how long was it after that? It could have been quite some time. And this is, to say, the first time we learn of that someone planted a vineyard and got drunk. And things happened after that.
Oh,
so that's one of the very weird bits. Any yes, comments?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I went back to a chart that I'd made. and of course, Ham, if you look all the way down there, his descendants were in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
So that would, you know, that was known for immorality and homosexuality, yes, and that kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yes. You're looking in chapter 10 now, are you? I know you said your chart, but what you're saying, that your chart is based upon chapter 10.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Because the other rather strange things that we keep getting in these chapters, which I remember are accounts of someone's lineage, is you keep getting genealogies getting in the way, which we don't like, but Hebrews do. So chapter 10, that's probably the one that you sort of skip past as you go from the flood to Babel. But you're quite right, there is an awful lot in the Hamite section because Ham is also the father of Cush, and Cush is the father of Nimrod. And Nimrod, of course, was the guy that eventually was going to build Babylon, Babel.
Paul?
Yeah?
Can I ask, going back to chapter 9, between verses 25 and 26, it mentions three times about Canaan being Shem's servant,
yeah,
or being a servant. So is there some link there that Canaan would be first of kind of a line of slaves or something, or a link with slavery?
Oh, I see what you mean, that this is probably the first mention of something like that happening.
Mm.
Very good point, yes. I hadn't picked that up or thought about that. But yes, this could be the origin of, or the first clear example of, where brothers are going to be subservient in some way.
Mm.
And therefore another, and all of this is about another notch away from the perfect scenario that God had wanted. And as you know, immediately after they're kicked out of Eden, everything starts to suddenly go bad. So you're right here. There's probably another sort of big disconnect happening here within the human family. Mm. Now there is going to be a greater sense of one people hurting another people.
Or yes.
Not treating them properly. Yeah, and thank you for picking up the fact that he's there three times, because again, I said repetition is important. Mm. He's cursing him with slavery or servitude, yeah, whatever you want to put it. Yeah.
And also, thank you, Paul, and also on another note, What does ervat mean?
The Hebrew.
The Hebrew that we were earlier talking about with nakedness.
Yeah, it means naked.
All right. Nakedness. Okay. Thank you.
Because thank you for reminding me of that, because I'll say something else in a minute about that, but not following right the way through. So I'll be teasing you to come back next week. If you, because this is the one in front of me.